Last case on this morning's call is number 023501, R.J. Harvey et al. Against the Office of Banks and Real Estate et al. Ms. Giro.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honor. I am Paula Giroux, and I, along with Joseph Gagliardo, represent the Illinois Office of Banks and Real Estate and its commissioner in this case. This case comes on appeal from a jury verdict in favor of Renault or R.J. Harvey and Ralph King. The jury found in favor of Mr. Harvey on one claim and in favor of Mr. King on four claims, and all of these claims are in this appeal. I'd like to take the case of Mr. Harvey first. Mr. Harvey claims that his position, which was manager of supervision at the Office of Banks and Real Estate, or OBRE as we call it, was reclassified lower from a senior public service administrator to public service administrator because of his race. The net effect of the reclassification was to change absolutely nothing in Mr. Harvey's job duties, benefits, salary. All it did, in essence, was give him job security.
But wasn't there evidence before the jury? I mean, this is actually a problem I had with your brief. Your brief read as though the jury only heard what you were talking about, and it heard a lot more than that. And wasn't there evidence before the jury, first of all, that the SPSA classification was the higher of the two classifications? It's similar to the SES in the federal government. It's the kind that you only have a term of years because it's a high enough position that full civil service protections don't apply. There was testimony from SPSA people that was true. There was testimony that there's a higher top salary range for it. There was all kinds of testimony that to move from SPSA to PSA was a downward movement. And why couldn't the jury credit that?
Well, the jury probably could note that Mr. Harvey was unhappy with losing his
SPSA. No, but in general, in the whole state of Illinois, to be SPSA is at a higher level than to be PSA. There was testimony that the jury could have said, this is a demotion. It's like moving from the top category into middle-level management.
Well, I think some of the cases that this court has decided recently, such as the Grayson case, where nothing changes in an employee's job, there's no adverse action. Everything stays the same.
Grayson,
the title doesn't matter.
Why isn't the lower salary cap enough to demonstrate an adverse employment?
Well, Mr.
Action.
Harvey,
I mean, there's about a $30,000 difference in salary caps. That's awfully significant to me.
It would be significant, perhaps, if Mr. Harvey was bumping up against the cap for the lower classification, the PSA, but he wasn't. He was about $6,000 below the cap even for PSA. So, and all the caps are raised each year. So there was no actual harm to Mr. Harvey at all. He was well within the limits of PSA.
There's kinds of responsibilities, though. In fact, you've used this argument as a sword. The kinds of responsibilities that go along with an SPSA job are more extensive than those that go with a PSA job. Although, once again, there was evidence in the record that the jury could have credited that Mr. Harvey, in fact, was still exercising the type of discretion to review legislation and to do other kinds of high-level management things, even when he got bumped down to PSA.
Your Honor, I think that it sort of is a reverse logic to say that his duties, or SPSA gives you duties. What you need to look at, and what was emphasized in this case, we hoped, was that you have to look at the employee's job description.
Right.
What
does
that employee do?
When you looked at his description, it turned out he was doing, the jury could have concluded, SPSA tasks, and yet he alone of the people in his relative position is moved down in this undated chart.
Well, I know that this court has on several occasions said that the hope that the jury will sort of second-guess the employer isn't enough to get you past summary judgment. And I would suggest here, too, that we had an abundance of evidence to say that his duties did not rise to the level of FTSA.
Did you move for summary judgment?
We did, Your Honor, and it was denied in a short opinion by Judge Anderson.
You know, I noted that you claim that Mr. Copley wasn't similarly situated because he had more education and was a CPA. And what I wondered was, how were his education and status as a CPA related to his job duties? I mean, he could have been a medical doctor, but that didn't mean he was entitled to higher pay in a job where that qualification would be utterly irrelevant to his job duties.
Well, his education and his CPA was not irrelevant, and in fact, there was testimony that Mr. Copley was required to keep up his CPA in order to retain his job.
But how was it related to his job duties? That's my question.
Okay, his job duties were very different than Mr. Harvey's. Mr. Harvey essentially made sure that mortgage brokers complied with licensing requirements of the state of Illinois. And when they were examined for licensure, if there were problems, it went to Mr. Harvey. Mr. Harvey wrote a letter and said, you have to correct ABC. And then there was a letter back saying, we've corrected. And Mr. Harvey oversaw that part of the mortgage banking division. Mr. Copley was in an entirely different division, which had to do with savings and loan banks. And he had a much more complex kind of job. He was looking at banks to see if they complied with state law, but these were savings and loans banks.
So why are savings and loans so inherently harder than mortgage brokers? I mean, they're actually substitutes for one another in the market to a certain degree.
Well,
you're saying that, but once again, could the jury have thought from the evidence before it? I have no doubt that you had evidence that it might have chosen to credit on your side. I absolutely grant you that, but what about the evidence on the other side? I mean, what we're going to have to do is go through this record and look at anything the jury might have chosen to believe, not how good your case was.
Well, back to Mr. Copley for a second, if I may. The reason that Mr. Copley was even mentioned is that he held the same title that Mr. Harvey did, manager of supervision in this separate division.
And one notch up had the same supervisors, mm-hmm. right? There's a layer at which they don't have the same supervisors, and then from the rest of the way up, it's the same people.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you get to the very highest level, they have the same supervisor. But the person who would be recommending increases, assigning job duties, all that sort of thing, for two levels up were different than Mr. Harvey had. But the reason that Mr. Copley was maintained at FTSA is his salary was too high to fit within TSA.
But that has nothing to do with the job. I mean, that has nothing to do with the job.
But it would be very harsh to say, we're going to lower your salary by $8,000 so you can fit in this job description.
But people, look, state agencies lay off people all the time because they reorganize, they riff, they try to save money, they do all sorts of things. I see this as a real shift in strategy. First you talk about the job requirements, and then you say, well, Mr. Copley is somebody that, you know, we're just going to keep even if we misclassify the job.
Well, Judge, it was not a matter of keeping him necessarily. It was just a matter of how the job should be classified. He was retained. There isn't any question about that. And there just was no...
But I'm assuming Mr. Copley would have quit if you lowered his salary and put him in a TSA job.
Well, there was no testimony to that, so I don't know what he would have done.
It just doesn't seem to me to be on the same wavelength as the other arguments. But anyway,
you know, the evidence on the last day of trial from Acting Commissioner Thompson certainly seemed like hearsay. Was it objected to at trial?
I don't believe that it was, Your Honor, and I think it would have been an exception in any event as a state of mind of Mr. Thompson. They were going over these organization charts preparatory to merging two agencies together, and the Central Management Services said, you know, this position doesn't look like an SPSA position.
Seemed to me he was testifying about what Hines and Stroh supposedly said at a meeting.
Well, I don't recall that there was an objection, Your Honor, but I believe it would be a state of mind exception to the hearsay rule.
Well, and if the jury decided not to credit it anyway, then you're asking us to override what the jury did in favor of some hearsay.
Well, that's not the only evidence that the PSA classification was correct. There was Commissioner Schaefer, and Harvey never suggested in any way that Commissioner Schaefer was a racist. He had no direct evidence that anyone, in fact, ever had any direct racial animus toward him. And Schaefer said, the reason that we're reclassifying, the reason I'm not going to reappoint you for another 4 years is I want to follow the personnel rules. And you really have to look at the personnel rules. It takes up a whole single space page as to how these positions are classified. And the two categories that you have to meet, one or the other, is that you have major administrative duties, and Mr. Harvey clearly didn't have that. He didn't supervise anybody. And then the other was you have to be policy making. And if you look at the job description, and the job description drives how a position is classified. Job description predominantly, 70 or 80%, talks about monitoring mortgage brokers. And only about 5% is things like thinking up new legislation for mortgage banking. So very, very small percentage. The vast majority would be more like administrative professional duties.
I wonder if we could turn to King and to the performance evaluation by Clark, because in this instance, with Clark's vacillating testimony about what day he received the memo and when they talked about it, why isn't this an instance in which the jury simply could have chosen to believe that Clark did get the memo and that Clark did take it into account?
Well, first, that would only apply to the retaliation
claim. Right, that's what I'm focusing on at the moment.
I think that if we even assume, for because we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable.
Right, and the memo that looks like the 9 gets turned into an 8.
Even if we assume that he saw the memorandum, that may get by some sort of prima facie case,
But it could be taken by the jury as evidence that he knew about it and then he took the unfavorable action, right?
It seems to me that the cases of this court that have addressed employment discrimination issues have said you have to focus on the reasons that were given. And Clark gave very specific reasons why he gave King the rating that he did. And those reasons were not refuted, and in fact, they were admitted.
Why does the jury have to believe every word that Clark said instead of also the evidence that Clark had in front of him, this critical memo from King? The jury didn't have to believe Clark's testimony.
The jury could very well believe. And we're assuming
it would have believed if it didn't have to believe when Clark said the reasons I evaluated him as I did were the following. Juries are entitled to decide on those things, aren't they?
It would seem that if those reasons were false, that his reports weren't late, that he did go in the field, as Clark said he did not, and that sort of thing, that King should have been able to contest those reasons and directly address them, and he didn't. He never addressed those reasons at all, or he admitted them. He admitted he didn't go in the field. He admitted his reports were late. He admitted he spent a lot of time correcting reports.
Clark says reason A, B, C. King comes in and says, you know, maybe A, B, and C were there, but the real motivating factor, the real thing that caused this evaluation was reason D, namely the May 7th memorandum. King has no obligation to meticulously take apart A, B, and C if he thinks they didn't make any difference, that the May 7th memorandum is what caused the action to happen.
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that that finding, that he did see the memorandum, only gets the plaintiff past some kind of initial showing, after which we get to say, this is why we did what we did.
But and then the jury didn't believe you. No. You're as though you're at a summary judgment stage. And this mm-hmm. court has made it absolutely clear that at this stage of the game, the only question is whether there was sufficient evidence in the record to allow the jury to find, in this instance, retaliation. Period. How it came in, what order it came in, who said what first, are all history.
Well, I'd like to, since my time is running out, I also would like to point out that under the Reeves versus Sanderson case, a jury verdict may be upheld if there's a prima facie case and there's evidence of pretext. In this case, our contention is that there was neither. And as far as the evaluation, Mr. King never showed that any similarly situated person was rated differently, and in fact, never showed how Clark rated anybody. And we would submit that he did not show a prima facie case. This case should never have gone to the jury. And the same with Mr. Harvey, that he did not show a prima facie case as far as an adverse action, with no change whatsoever in any part of his job duties, salary, or benefits, and there was no adverse action, no prima facie case. If there are no other questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Jerome. May I help you here now from Ms. Salt?
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Soule, and I represent Mr. Harvey and Mr. King here on this appeal. This is a case where we tried the case before a jury for 4.5 weeks, and the jury was able to observe the demeanor and the credibility of the witnesses. The jury rejected the proposition placed before it by the defendants. The defendants on this appeal largely make their arguments based on facts that the jury rejected. The evidence was that the defendants did not honestly believe the reasons they gave for the actions against the plaintiffs with respect to each of them.
There's no argument on this appeal, is there, about the instructions given to the jury?
No. In fact, the instructions here went to the ultimate issue of intentional discrimination, and each of the instructions included a specific interrogatory that there was adverse action on each and every claim. And that's one of the key issues that was proposed by defendants, and that was argued before the jury. So that factual determination was addressed in the context of the trial by the jury and the court. In this case, the defendants had changing rationales with respect to their actions, and they had this with respect to both plaintiffs, Harvey and King. This is a case much like Emil, or this is a case much like Zakagnini, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is a recent case from this court, where the changing stories create the appearance of a dishonesty. And people would not believe, after hearing his testimony, the things that Clark said to justify the reasons for the actions that he took against Mr. King. His credibility was particularly damaged at the trial. This case also included evidence of racial comments of one of the key decision makers in Mr. Harvey's case. She was part of the decision-making process where he was demoted. She provided negative input. She had made racially stereotypical comments about African-American workers. She called Mr. Harvey Alter Boy, and she did a number of other things that are outlined in our brief that indicate that she had racial animus.
Ms. Soule, I wonder if I could ask you to focus on Mr. King's case and the aspect of his case that focuses on the second promotion. Because there's a Rule 50 motion here too that got denied. And with respect to that second incident when Kaufman is hired as assistant director, we have an interview panel with a couple of people who give significantly more points to Kaufman, 225, right, as opposed to the 135 to King. And we also have the evidence about Mr. King's lack of enthusiasm about moving to Springfield, maybe questioning whether that was really necessary given the fact that somebody else had performed that job from Chicago. But why wasn't it up to the agency, even if someone in the past had done that job from Chicago, to decide that it should be done in Springfield? And why wasn't it a really neutral factor saying, well, if you don't want to be in Springfield, I guess you can't do this job, not to mention that you're so many points below?
Judge, I think you have to look at the 1998 promotion denial in the context of the prior act. If the agency's proffered reason, one of the reasons, the Springfield issue, did not have to be believed either. The 1998 promotion denial came after King was denied in 1997, and prior to that, although it wasn't a claim here, it was still part of the evidence, in 1996, Mr. Kaufman, whom Mr. King had also trained, had been promoted over him. The practice of the agency was to post jobs only when they had made their sort of undocumented informal determination that they didn't want an internal candidate. Mm-hmm. So with respect to, and we claim that that in effect has caused the disparity in some ways with respect to minorities in those high level jobs. But with respect to the 1998 job, the posting went up, and it's about at that point that Mr. King received the clear message: you were denied in 97, you complained in 1997, no one responded to your complaint at all. You then were subject to this performance evaluation. Now we're going to set up this process that had all these other aspects to it about Springfield and the cat and mouse game and all these other issues. We think you can't divorce that from the history of the conduct, and the Springfield reason need not be believed and should not be given credibility. In addition, Mr. Clark was part of that panel. And just as in Mr. Harvey's case with respect to Ms. Brennan, when the decision-making group includes the individual whose credibility and animus could be found by the jury based on the facts, was part of it, we think that allowed them to infer that the discriminatory pattern of denying Mr. King that job was simply continuing into the 1998 promotion.
Can you remind me if the sheets, I think the sheets are in the record that everybody marked for those interviews. Do we have each individual sheets, or did they do it as a group?
Have individual sheets. Mm-hmm. I would have to check to see if each and every individual was in there. But again, Mr. Kaufman, who was selected over Mr. King, at this point in the game he was an outside candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He was someone who they were reaching out. He had left the agency, and the evidence had showed that he left the agency because he didn't think the job was a good opportunity for him, which we had to demonstrate to Mr. Clark through showing him prior statements that he made. With respect to each of these claims, the pretext was extremely strong, and the evidence of pretext. We also had statistical evidence as to both the SPSA, the underrepresentation of African Americans in SPSA jobs, and as to the numbers of African Americans who received the highest performance evaluations. And that evidence as well takes us beyond the kind of inquiry of one person's qualifications versus the next. With respect to Mr. King and Mr. Harvey's claims, plaintiffs established at trial that there was sufficient discriminatory intent as to each one of their claims. As to Mr. King's claims, his qualifications were far superior to Mr. Turner's, and under the Millbrook case, qualifications can be examined if the other types of evidence of discrimination exist. Here we have the covering of the tracks, and it's important to understand that not only with respect to the retaliation claim concerning Mr. King, but also the 1997 promotion denial. And that is because the reason that was offered for not giving King that job was that he lacked computer skills. This reason doesn't appear in defendant's opening brief, but it was the reason that Commissioner Schaefer stated and that Mr. King was denied. Mr. Clark, although his credibility is questioned, he agreed that Schaefer's testimony was correct. That justification was proven to be phony before the jury because Ralph King was chosen as the agency's point person to monitor the information systems of banks in Chicago leading up to the Y2K scare.
Well, in your brief on page 12, I'm not sure where this is from, whether perhaps his testimony, you say that Mr. King was a computer programmer, senior programmer analyst, systems analyst, senior systems analyst, and systems project manager before he started with OBRE.
That's correct. That all of that is
all
correct.
Of that's in the record, an extensive
yes.
background.
And so in the face of that evidence, to have the commissioner and Mr. Clark say he didn't have the requisite computer skills, certainly was eye-opening to the jury and certainly then added to the evidence in terms of this is not really what the reason is. With respect to Mr. Harvey's claim, he was in fact similarly situated to Roger Copley. Roger Copley stated, understanding both jobs and having worked with Mr. Harvey for years, they basically did the same thing. Assistant Commissioner Stevenson also testified just out of hand when he would introduce Mr. Harvey and Mr. Copley to the new commissioner, he referred to them as counterparts. That's because they were, and the educational background did not change what each of them did with respect to their regulatory duties. With respect to Mr. Copley, Mr. Stevenson also agreed that he basically did the same job. They were one-on-one comparison, and if you, the same rationales that they offer, and they, of course, changed that over the course of the trial, or the last day of the trial, and on appeal here, but if you take the first rationale, or any of them, they would apply equally to Copley. But again,
what about supervision of people? Was Copley supervising five or six people?
I'm not sure whether he was. He may have had an individual underneath him that he was supervising. But with respect to Mr. Harvey, the evidence at trial was that Ms. Brennan did not want Mr. Harvey in that job in the first place. She was told to pick someone from within. She did that, but for the 4 years of that predestined time when he was going to be up for reappointment or not, she treated him very poorly. She took away things that he needed. She denied him office support. She denied him the very people that would be reporting to him. Mr. Schaefer, when he did undertake the changes recommended by the, that he chose, recommended by the Drazek report, stated in that very memo that certain individuals would report to Mr. Harvey. It was only after that continuing conduct by Ms. Brennan that those individuals under him were removed. And all that is a course of conduct that we think supports the demotion being discriminatory. With respect to damages, we think the damages awarded to each one of the plaintiffs in this case are appropriate and are well within the mainstream of the cases this court has decided. With respect to the defendant's response on the damages, they act as though the only testimony in the record is the few things we were cited in our brief, and that's simply not the case. There was testimony from Mr. King concerning all the damages that he suffered, and there was also testimony from Mr. King's brother. Mr. King, of course, was not with us at the time of the trial. Mr. King testified that he was just thrown by the wayside by Mr. Clark. He testified that the agency made it crystal clear to him that he would not get promoted, and he asked, why would he waste his time? He testified that he considered getting psychiatric help. He testified that the conduct was very damaging, that it affected his motivation, caused him to become paranoid, not want to go to work. King testified that it was like Clark looked at him and said, you are out. I don't care what your background is, you are never going to advance. Mr. King testified that everyone in the division knew he had more seniority than Turner, and the fact that Clark gave the job to Turner over him was like a blow, he testified to at page 1426. People looked at him in a different light, he testified on that same page. It was a smack in his face not to consider him, he testified. He testified he believed he was treated like somebody they were going to get rid of. Mr. King testified he was very embarrassed by Clark after he made the complaint, and he relayed the incident where he was treated so badly that other individuals, his peers, were embarrassed and they had to put their heads down on the table. Melvin King, his brother, testified as well concerning the damages that Mr. King suffered, and he testified that he saw Ralph every night or every other night at the time or at around the time he was passed over for the promotion. Ralph told Melvin that he couldn't handle some things and that he was very stressed. Melvin testified that during this period of time, Ralph started keeping to himself. He became very down. Melvin began to bring him meals and noted that there was something negative going on with Ralph's personality. Melvin had testified that when Ralph received the job at OBRE, it was the best thing that ever happened to him. And Ralph, you could tell from his testimony, as well as the prior supervisor's comments, had really worked hard. He was the kind of person whose character depended on how he felt about that job. With respect to Mr. Melvin King's testimony, he indicated Mr. Ralph King wasn't as happy like he used to be. He could tell that he had changed, and Melvin testified Ralph was not happy because of what happened at work. And this was during the time period after he didn't get the promotion. Similar testimony was elicited concerning the damages suffered by Mr. Harvey. With respect to that, defendants omit reference to Reverend Lambert, who testified that he counseled Mr. Harvey on 15 to 20 occasions. Mr. Lambert testified that the feelings of Mr. Harvey about what had happened to him, particularly about being brought to the church on the day that he was demoted, that was extremely upsetting to Mr. Harvey. Reverend Lambert testified that he talked to Mr. Harvey about the demotion, that Mr. Harvey was upset, Mr. Harvey was shaken, Mr. Harvey was frustrated. Mr. Lambert testified that he had experienced counseling individuals and he understood this matter was taking its toll on Mr. Harvey. With respect to each of the claims, the plaintiffs demonstrated and the jury concluded properly and rationally that the conduct at issue was a result of intentional discrimination. Each of the acts undertaken constituted an adverse action, including with the evaluation, because one's raise is tied to the rating. And with respect to the series of false statements that Mr. Clark made at the trial, the jury was entitled to discredit any reasons he gave for anything. He apparently forged a document. He denied having the complaint on the day that he did have it, and he went back and forth, as we outline in our brief, in a way that certainly would have caused the jury to disbelieve his testimony. For those reasons, we ask that the jury verdicts be sustained and that the other rulings of the court be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Saul. Mr. Rue, your time has expired. Therefore, the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel. The court has completed the call of the day, and so we will stand in a recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.